but and I was trying to be a
listen, go, that's not Taylor, you know, right. But I was just enough, right?
Yeah, okay. You were perfect. You were Taylor, but like, you know,
you're in the other studio, actually.
Oh, wait, I think I hear you now.
Can you hear me now?
We're hearing now.
How about this one?
Yeah.
No, we're.
I think we're hearing in the studio.
A million to go, hopefully.
Tell
me the truth?
Oh.
No, you wouldn't. You know I would crumble and die.
I cannot tell the truth.
That's why I love
you.
Me too.
All right, well, I'll call B-Nac. Because I don't know what else.
The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
I am Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Thank you for joining us this Easter week for Just Love, when we explore the church in the world and we explore what's going on in our world and we seek to kind of think about it and learn more about it and to look at it from our perspective of our Catholic social teaching, how we should be trying to create a world that is more just and is more compassionate. It's a little bit challenging, even in this Easter season, when we look for hope and we look for new life, to realize that sadly, it seems that acts of terror and violence, both here in the United States and abroad, continue to dominate headlines. And, you know, some events, however, which is interestingly, but I would say not surprisingly, receive more recognition than others. So we're going to explore kind of terrorism and how they're covered today, which is, I think, very, very important for us in the United States, because we're going to explore the fact that how some events seem to get more publicity and more coverage than others. And I don't think it's surprising, but those that happen in Northern Europe seem to get more attention than those who happen in other places. So we're going to be speaking with a couple of our guests who can kind of speak to us about those particular topics. So it's not a upbeat show, but I think what it does is, particularly in this Easter season, it reminds us that, you know, the salvation in Jesus Christ, Jesus is Savior of the entire world and not just a Savior of our own country or our own culture or that with which we are familiar, and is the Savior of everybody, all places. And therefore, kind of as we look at the world through our kind of Christian eyes, while, you know, we understand things that are closer to home, we also need to realize that things are going on in other parts of the world that maybe we don't have a firsthand knowledge of, or maybe we don't have a lot of experience with. We haven't visited there, but the people who are impacted by those are equally made in God's image and likeness. And, you know, we have to be aware that those things also merit our attention. They merit our prayer. They merit our action in trying to make that part of our world more just and more compassionate. So before we go to our first guest, Tom, is there any news that you want to share with our listeners? Or maybe we will go. We'll go to our first guest first, and then we'll kind of do news later on in the show. So our first guest is Sean Darling Hammond, who is he is at a multinational law firm in London, in Washington, and he studied at Harvard and the Berkeley Law School. And he's going to talk to us about some of the issues related to how the media covers terrorism. So, Sean Darling Hammond, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me, Monsignor Sullivan.
Great. I am delighted. So give our listeners just a little bit of feel for how you got into the work you're doing. Where'd you start up? Where'd you grow up? Just a little bit so we get a little of the color commentary on the important topic that we're going to be discussing for a few minutes today.
Sure. So my background is in sociological methods that allow us to get an empirical sense of what's happening in the world. So I've used that to study poverty and education, and recently in the article that I wrote for The Nation to study the extent of coverage that incidents of terrorism received throughout the world in 2015. And I did that largely because there was a huge hue and cry after the Charlie Hebdo shooting in January, and there was a sort of comparative lack of coverage of an attack in Yemen. Then again in November, when there was an attack in Paris, there was a lot of coverage, but there was a comparative lack of coverage of similar attacks in Iraq and Lebanon that happened in the same week. So I just wanted to see if empirically there was actually a disparity in the amount of coverage that was being received, and if so, what that disparity was, and if so, whether that disparity translated to disparities throughout coverage in the year.
That's pretty interesting. And how'd you get interested in that topic? I mean, how did you kind of say that was something you wanted to kind of learn more about?
I think it really started with the heart, to be honest. I was seeing really shocking and saddening images of what happened in Beirut, which was a city that I actually worked in many years ago. So immediately, as soon as the bombing happened in Beirut, the bombings, I reached out and asked if my friends were okay. And then I was shocked that it was so unknown to folks in the U.S. And to folks that I know in Europe as well. Everybody was talking about Paris and nobody was talking about Beirut. And so I started to try to figure out why that was, because my friends in Beirut were just as important as my friends in Paris. And I thought the world ought to know what was happening in Beirut so we could focus on it. We could try to ameliorate those kinds of incidents of horrific terror anywhere in the world, no matter who they affect.
Now, in fact, while, as you said, you know, anecdotally and kind of, you know, we might say, gee, we seem to hear more about Paris than we did about Beirut. But you actually kind of did some empirical research about that so that you could kind of see if you could back up your intuition or what we think anecdotally. So tell us a little bit about the research you did to see if empirically what we kind of intuitively think is borne out by the facts.
Yeah, and I should start by saying when I began studying terrorism incidents and, you know, any disparities in coverage, my hope, my hypothesis, you know, sort of my optimistic hypothesis was that I wouldn't see any disparities in coverage, that really what was going on was that we all live in social media vacuums and we weren't seeing as much coverage because our social media worlds weren't talking about these issues as much. But I wanted to see if that was true or if it really was the case that the media was covering certain incidents of terrorism more often. So what I did was I looked at Google News' aggregator. If you search for example, terrorism incident, Paris, November, you'll see a batch of articles regarding the terrorism incidents that happened in that month. And if you narrow it down by a day, then you'll see the ones that happened on that day. And what I found right away was there were about 21,000 articles written about the November Paris terrorist incident, and that compared to less than 2,000 collectively for the Beirut and Baghdad incidents to combine. So, you know, I was seeing 10 times less coverage for two incidents of terrorism that affected dozens and dozens of people than I was for a single incident that occurred in the West. And then, of course, as soon as I told my fiance about it, she said, well, that could also be anecdotal. Maybe what's going on is that those three incidents of terrorism are not representative of a larger trend. And if you looked at all of 2015 coverage, you'd see a different trend. And again, I kind of had this optimistic hypothesis that that was the case, that maybe what happened was there was something unique about the Paris attack that made media cover it so much more than other incidents of terrorism in other parts of the world. And I was wrong. It turns out that an incident of terrorism in the West receives substantially more coverage, almost no matter what country it occurs in, how many people pass away, than an incident of terrorism that occurs in the Middle East or in Africa or even in Eastern Europe. And I was sort of shocked by the scope of these discrepancies.
And I assume that when you kind of discovered this, your a naturally inquisitive mind would say, okay, so why is that the case? You know, we now seem to have some evidence that it is the case, but then the question is, well, why is it the case? And did you kind of move in that direction to begin to ask some questions about why maybe it was so?
Yeah, absolutely. So I sort of went into this analysis with the knowledge of specific explanations that the media has offered for why we see so much coverage. And the first one, obviously, I already talked about is the media often has responded, we are covering everything, you're just not reading and sharing our articles. And that's just simply not the case. If an individual dies in a non-Western country as a result of an incident of terrorism, their death will be written about in 11 times fewer articles than an individual who dies in an incident of terrorism in the West. So sort of if you consider the amount of coverage to be some proxy of the amount of attention or importance that the media places on a given life, lives in the Western world have 11 times more importance than lives in the non-Western world when they are lost to terrorism. So that just wasn't the case. It wasn't really social media. It was actually media. The next sort of explanation that's often offered is, well, countries in the West are often not victimized by terrorism. It's often so it's more novel, and that novelty is what drives the amount of coverage. So I looked at that, and I tried to see which countries were experiencing novel incidents of terrorism in 2015 and how much coverage those novel incidents received. And I found an incident of terrorism in Chad, as an example, that took dozens of lives, including a policymaker's life, that only received 500 articles. And again, that's comparing it to the 21-plus thousand articles that the Paris attacks in November received. So novel incident of terrorism, not a lot of coverage. And as I started to try to look at other novel incidents of terrorism, I found that there was really no correlation between novelty and the amount of coverage. What really was driving it was whether the incident, novel or not, happened in the West.
We're speaking with Sean Darling Hammond, who has kind of looked at how terrorism is covered in the media and has discovered through some of the empirical research he's done is that there's far more coverage by stories if the terrorist incident occurs in the West than it does in other parts. Sean, so, but let me ask you this. What if I were to say to you, well, doesn't the media report on what kind of people are interested in? And so they're more interested in kind of the Paris stuff than the Chad stuff, and therefore they write more articles because that's what people's going to read.
Yeah, and I think there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem there, right? Because as you mentioned at the top of this show, we as, you know, regardless of our faith, I think we should care about people no matter where they're from, and we should be just as incensed by senseless acts of violence affecting people in Nigeria, which has just been ravaged by terrorism in the last couple of years, as we are by incidents of terrorism in Belgium or France. So to the extent that, you know, the response is, well, the media is giving people what they want, well, people are going to want to hear about incidents of terrorism in specific countries if they have no context for the other country. So if we're not learning about what's happening in Africa and the Middle East and Eastern Europe, if we're not humanizing those stories in a deep way, then yeah, people are going to be more want to consume stuff about Western Europe and about the U.S. because that's been humanized. But if the media sort of takes up its obligation to humanize stories, no matter where they happen, to talk about the victims and the people affected in really human terms, then I think that human connection will come through naturally. I mean, the attacks recently in Lahore in Pakistan were just – they were terrible. You're talking about Easter Sunday – kids in parks. That is not a hard article to humanize. And yet the amount of coverage was far less than the coverage we saw of the Belgium attack. Not that the Belgium attack shouldn't have been covered. It should. But so should Lahore. And the type of coverage was just more sanitized. Sort of, this attack happened and, oh, isn't that too bad, and it's going to really destabilize the region. Whereas the attacks in Belgium immediately were focused on individuals and their lives cut short and how tragic that was and who they were and where they were from and why we should care and what we can do so this never happens again. It's just sort of the heart needs to be in it, and the media has an obligation to put their hearts in it so people can have their hearts really focused on atrocities no matter who they affect.
Yeah, sure. Let me share with you something that I've discovered, which I believe kind of confirms what you're saying. One of the things I do sometimes when I go to the gym is I listen to BBC World Service, that news channel, and I listen to it because what I hear is news from parts of the world that I don't hear about on the standard brand's American media. So I hear about different countries in Africa, in Asia, where I never hear a story about if I'm looking at the mainstream American media. And it does open up to you a sense that the world is bigger than you're usually kind of bombarded with. And so my own experience resonates with what you're telling me, is that I have to go to another station which originates in another country in order to get that broader perspective as to what's going on in parts of Africa and parts of Asia.
Yeah, and imagine if you didn't, right? Imagine if you could just turn on NBC or ABC or Fox or MSNBC and you would instantly be finding out what's happening to anybody anywhere, to human beings no matter where they are. You just feel more connected to the global community, and especially for the next generation, for the kids who are coming up with this stuff, who don't have a preset sense of who's more like them, quote unquote, and who's not like them and who they should care about more or less. For them to be able to exist in a world where the media is living up to its obligation to talk about human stories no matter where they happen or what people look like, for them, that would be amazing. It would be paradigm shifting.
Well, and again, Sean, what I would say is that the media no longer has any excuse. And the reason why I say that is because there are so many outlets for media, and there's so much 24-hour news cable stuff. And, I mean, I think it's kind of a common joke. There are some of the stations that you could watch, and after 20 minutes, all it is repeats of the previous 20 minutes. So it's not that, I mean, they're looking to fill the space, and they don't have to keep repeating 10 times the same story. They could just do it 5 times and then cover things in other parts of the world.
I couldn't agree more. I actually started researching media coverage in 2004 for my thesis when I was at Harvard. I was looking at presidential coverage in that election cycle. And what I was immediately struck by was just how repetitive the news has become, especially on 24-hour stations, as you mentioned. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, they have major resources. They can utilize them to cover stories around the world and to really sort of tap into the human experience everywhere. Couldn't agree more.
But you know what? I do think one of the things you said that probably needs to be a little bit nuanced. It is a question of resources, and I think what they decide is that they're not going to devote as many resources to covering news, and therefore it's a lot cheaper to do a story once and repeat it 10 times than to have to spend the resources to cover 3 or 4 additional stories, especially if they're in other parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is definitely part of the motivating cognition behind it, but it sort of speaks to the extent to which we have forgotten, many businesses, I think, have forgotten that the primary purpose of a business ought not to be money and making the most money for shareholders. It ought to be value in the community that you serve, whatever business you have. That should be the primary driver. And typically, if you focus on doing the thing that your business is designed to do well for people, then the money follows. It may not be as much every quarter, but it will be. You'll be competitive because you'll be meeting a need. And to the extent that media outlets decide that they're going to meet that need, they're going to humanize stories around the world, they're going to make sure that no matter where somebody is, if they're affected by something horrific, that people are aware of it, people can respond by pressuring their policymakers to try to make sure that those sorts of things aren't happening anywhere. To the extent that media outlets are doing that, I think they will find that they have a receptive and a really core audience that will stick with them and won't be sort of moved by the repetitive news on the station just a few channels up.
Well, listen, I am so grateful that you have taken the time to be with us to share some of your research and your perspective. And I think you've given us, for our listeners, you've kind of opened up a sense that we shouldn't be just looking at our own culture, our own world, and look at further places. So, Sean, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, and thank you for doing the work that you're doing.
Absolutely my pleasure, Monsignor Sullivan, and thank you so much for having me on the program. It was truly an honor.
Great. Sean Darling Hammond, who is an attorney and who has kind of pointed out the fact that our media is a little bit targeted in what it covers and doesn't cover some of the terrorist and violence in other parts of the world. It kind of is focused on the Western world and maybe Western Europe to that extent. So anyway, thank you for being with us on Just Love. And we're going to come back in just 2 minutes and we're going to continue our conversation about how do we deal with some of the feelings and the empathy that we deal with violence and how do we kind of make sure that we're not just focused on our own world. So join us when we come back in a few minutes. This is Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. It is Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Love God, neighbor, self, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We are in Easter week, the week of the resurrection. Every week, quite frankly, is the week of the resurrection because Jesus is risen from the dead and he lives. So we kind of celebrate that. We celebrate new life. We celebrate hope. And it coincides with spring and, you know, hopefully we get more warmer weather, although I have to say, Tom, those of us in the Northeast, we can't complain this past winter. Not bad.
Oh, no. Monsieur, it was not bad. It was great.
And I want to give thanks to God for the way he did snow this year. God really got snow right in New York. He came on a sad day. We got the most snow ever. They tell us we were a tenth of an inch short of ever, but I'm saying we got the most snow ever. Okay. And then God took it away by Tuesday.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, God, you did snow good this year. Keep up the work because we got, you know, imagine if we got 5 inches six times.
Right.
That gets like yicky and sloppy. So we got all of it at once. It was great. So I like it.
No, I couldn't agree more, Mazir. And also, when it comes all at once, it's kind of fun because you can walk around in it and it's very beautiful and you can play in it. And then if it's gone by the next day, then you don't have to deal with it, which is perfect.
So it is good. So it is good. So anyway, Tom, we got any news?
We sure do. You know, I know when you and Sean were having the conversation before, Monsignor, Sean had mentioned a little bit about the bombing in Lahore. And I just think for our Just Love audience, so they could wind up listening to it. Sadly, on Easter Sunday morning in Lahore, which is an area of Pakistan that's very populated by Christians, the Pakistani Taliban called Jamaat-ul-Abrar, conducted a suicide bombing operation in a park that is frequented by the Christian community. And again, Sean had indicated it was by a swing set. This person walked over to where the swing set was. 70 people were killed, predominantly women and children. Over 300 were injured. And later on, spokesman for the group, the Taliban, claimed responsibility, stating that the target was Christians, that they wanted to send a message to Pakistani Prime Minister Sharif, that they had entered Lahore, and that he could do what he wanted, but he wouldn't be able to stop them, that the suicide bombings will continue. And I should say that Lahore is where Prime Minister Sharif is from originally, Monsignor. And again, it was the bloodiest attack on Christians in Pakistan since 2013, when there was a church bombing there that killed 80 people. Christians in Pakistan are roughly 1.6% of the population, which in Pakistan is 192 million. It also wasn't the first time, as you may recall, that the Pakistani Taliban had targeted children. I know you and Sean were talking about the importance of bringing up individuals. You may remember Malala. She was the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize 2 years ago. And, of course, she was targeted by the Pakistani Taliban because she was an advocate of children's reading and rights to read. The Pope called the attack cowardly and senseless, and he urged civil authorities and social actors in the area to carry out all efforts to renew security and serenity of the population, particularly for religious minorities. So again, we keep them in our prayers.
Yeah, it is kind of very interesting, and the point of bringing this up is one of those very kind of tragic and sad realities in the world that again goes underreported. And it's underreported that there is a tremendous amount of attack and persecution of Christians throughout the world. And let me be clear about this. I am disappointed that it doesn't get as much attention as it should. But I think one of the reasons it doesn't is because we also need to be careful that when the attacks come in countries which are heavily non-Christian, whether they be Muslim, whether they be Hindu, that wherever those attacks occur, that we don't paint a whole people with a negative impression that everybody of a particular religion is kind of out to get us or is perpetrating that. No, that's not the case at all. But we have to do recognize the fact that in so many parts of the world, Christians are under attack. They are being persecuted. They're being driven out of where they have traditionally lived, or they're actually being killed. They're being blown up as part of a terrorist attack. And it is not, you know, anti-Muslim to say that. It's not anti any other religion to say that. It's just to recognize that that's the reality in the world. And we have to kind of stand up and say that that's not acceptable. You know, it, just as it's not acceptable to say that, you know, in our country, we're not going to let in people to the country because they're of a particular religion. So, I mean, we can't pretend that there's not evil in the world. We can't pretend that there aren't bad things happening because we're a little careful. We always need to be careful, but that doesn't mean we can't speak the truth about what's going on in the world. And so, you know, the fact that this bomb was done in a park which is known to be kind of a place where Christians play and Christian families recreate, I mean, you have to draw the conclusion that that was bombed there because they wanted to attack Christians. And so that's a very, very awful, it's a very sensitive thing. We have to raise it up to realize that that's what's going on in the world, and we have to stand in solidarity with individuals like who are the victims of that. And I will say in the next few weeks, we're going to be talking a lot more about Christians who are under persecution in different parts of the world, in the Middle East. We're going to do a show or two on that in a few weeks from now to talk about that particular reality, which is very, very important. Tom, is there any other news?
There is, Mr. You know, there's another thing that I think is very tragic, but I think it's important we remember at this time of year is people who are hungry at this time of year. And there's a couple of things that have happened over this past weekend, Easter weekend, around the country where Catholic Charities has come in and helped to feed people. One of them was down in the Diocese of Las Vegas, Nevada. Catholic Charities of Southern Nevada fed an estimated 1,100 people a full Easter dinner, ham and all the fixings, in a downtown Las Vegas headquarters. They had the assistance of 75 volunteers who helped serve and 22 volunteers who helped them cook. And it was paid for by a chicken finger restaurant called Raising Cane. They actually paid for all of the food that was served to the folks down there. And also in the Archdiocese of Chicago, they had an interesting thing where those folks who rely on Meals on Wheels actually were visited not only by the people who delivered the food, but also they were accompanied by decision makers in Lake County over in the state of Illinois, including the mayors of Mundelein and the mayors of Libertyville, and state lawmakers and other officials who accompanied the folks from Catholic Charities to kind of come and meet with and talk to some of the people who Catholic Charities feeds on a regular basis, the senior citizens who are homebound. To kind of meet them and to raise the awareness of hunger in our communities.
Just having finished Holy Week, which is kind of the holiest time of our religious year, in which there a lot of time is spent in church, and the services are longer than usual. There are more readings from the Bible than usual. There are, as I would say, add-ons to the kind of traditional Mass in terms of different liturgical rites and rituals that go on there to celebrate what is at the center of our faith. And so there's a lot of time spent in church. So I think it's absolutely critically important that we realize that if we're going to celebrate our religion, we're going to express our religion, you got to worry about what's going on outside of church. So I mentioned to our listeners that Cardinal Dolan on Holy Thursday, which is a very important day when we kind of remember that the Eucharist was begun on that day, the central act of worship of our Christian faith. The Cardinal Dolan, before celebrating that Mass, went up in one part of New York, in kind of Manhattan, in the northern part, to actually help distribute food bags to those families who come to a Catholic Charities food pantry, which we actually call an ecumenical food pantry because we use the space in a Methodist church to do it. And as part of his Holy Thursday service, Cardinal Dolan went up there to distribute food to those families who were there. And again, to give our listeners a sense of the need, at that food pantry, pretty much every week, we provide packages of food, 9 meals, to over 300 households there. So that at the end of the year, if you just kind of do the little bit multiplication, we wind up handing out almost 300,000 meals to the people who are in that neighborhood. Many of them are immigrants. Many of them are longtime residents, too. They're senior citizens who are there. So it is a variety of people whom we help in that food pantry. And Cardinal Dolan went up there to symbolize and to, in fact, communicate the reality that this is something that is important to do for the sake of the community, that it is important that we do this as an expression of our Christian faith. So that is very, very important. So I think what we'll do is we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk with our second guest and continue our conversation about incidents of kind of terror in the world, violence, and how we relate to them. How do we feel about them? What is our own reaction to them? So this is Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just. It will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in 2 minutes. On the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Even though this is Easter week, and it's a week of hope and of celebration in the resurrection in our Christian tradition, the topic we're talking about this week is not terribly uplifting, because it's a topic that recognizes the reality in the world is a world in which there's a lot of violence, and some of the violence just seems to be senseless, and it's explicable, but it's not something that is really we're able to get our hands around. Just some of the suicide bombings, some of the terrorism, some of the victims who clearly are innocent families and children. So we've been kind of exploring that this week, and you know, how do we cover it? How do we kind of realize what's going on in the world? Do we focus in one area more than another? And kind of on a little bit of a spiritual or an emotional level, how do we kind of feel about it? How do we empathize with different types of terrorist attacks in different parts of the world? How do we kind of figure out what's going on and how we react to those things? And kind of to explore that topic, we're going to be speaking of a director from Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, Emma Sepalala, and we're going to be speaking about that topic. Emma, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Great. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the topic that you're currently studying.
Well, as a graduate student at Stanford University, I was just thrilled to be there in my first year. I just couldn't believe how lucky and fortunate I was. And yet that same year, I heard there were three suicides on our campus, and I got very concerned as to what leads people to be unhappy and also what leads people to be happy, which is and the topic that I ended up researching in graduate school. And I just published a book called The Happiness Track on this topic. And that's really how I got interested in this. And as I was going through the literature and also through my own experience, I found that the greatest path to happiness is really compassion.
And so you kind of continued studying that particular topic.
Mm-hmm. Correct. I started looking at different methods that people have used throughout the ages, such as meditation, to increase that feeling of compassion and connection to others. Because really, when you're looking at a terrorist attack, it's a profound lack of empathy. How does that happen? So that happens through a profound sense of disconnect from others. When you feel that sense of belonging, that sense of connection, what we hear about a lot in Christ's message is that sense of seeing someone else as yourself, seeing your neighbor, treating your neighbor as you would yourself. And that is something that we are actually innately built to do. But through things like brainwashing and stress and life circumstances, trauma, sometimes people disconnect. And so through practices that generate compassion, we can really start to create that sense of belongingness again.
So the book, The Happiness Track, tell us a little bit about that book. What did you write about in that? Absolutely. And what's that about?
Again, when I was at Stanford and Silicon Valley, people that were incredibly talented, incredibly fortunate to be studying, working in the fields that they were in, whether they were startup engineers, very excited to innovate and disrupt the world of technology, or starting a nonprofit, or these Stanford students that were just so incredibly intelligent and motivated. I also saw a lot of burnout. People were just working themselves into the ground. They believed they had the misconception that in order to be successful, they had to postpone or even sacrifice their happiness. But if you look at the research, you actually are going to...
You know, Emma, I think what we're going to have to do is maybe we're going to try to give you a call back, because we're having a little bit of trouble. I think our line might not be clear, and so we're going to have to give you a call back to try to make sure that our listeners can hear the kind of the important
Absolutely.
Things that you have to say. So okay, so
hold on one second. Let me just move. Is this better here?
So we'll try to get Emma back, and we'll make sure that that we can, because the topic that she's talking about is something that is very, very important, and I don't want us to lose the topic of what we are doing. And it's you know, it is a it's a very problematic world in the terms of that, you know, there is a lot of striving for happiness, but you know, we do see people who seemingly are kind of successful, and all of a sudden something goes wrong. And you would think, as Emma began to talk about, that as she was studying at Stanford, there were a lot of people who were achieving very well, they were very successful, but yet there were incidences of suicide there. And that's a very kind of troubling. It's very difficult to figure out why exactly that was happening. So let's go back to Emma and let's kind of continue our conversation. Emma, thanks again. I'm sorry that we had a bad connection, and I hope we have a better one this time.
Sure thing.
Go ahead.
So should I answer your question? Okay.
Sure.
The reason I wrote the happiness track is that I saw while I was at Stanford with these highly talented students in Silicon Valley with these incredibly innovative engineers and tech startup individuals that are working so hard, was that many people fall for the misconception that in order to be successful, you have to postpone or even sacrifice your happiness. Yet if you look at the research, which I was deeply involved with, you see that if you take better care of yourself, and if you take care of the people around you, if you really nurture yourself, your relationship, and take the time you need to nurture your own well-being, you actually are going to be more focused, more productive, more charismatic. People are more loyal to you, and you do better in the long run. So I really wanted to get them.
And so if in a certain sense, you might say that you kind of have to pay attention to your own well-being if you're going to try to interact well with other people.
That's correct. We're seeing rates of burnout at 50% across industries. So whether you work for a nonprofit or a big corporation, we're seeing that. We're seeing that 70% of the American workforce is disengaged and unhappy at work. And if you think about the amount of time we spend at work and how important it is, what a large part of our life it is, it's really important looking at, you know, what is it that leads to your own well-being? And if you look at that, you actually see that yourself by taking time to nurture calmness in your life, manage your energy better, you know, instead of driving yourself to the ground and with high doses, scheduling yourself, you actually are going to be more productive. The other thing is many people fall for the idea that it's a dog-eat-dog world. You have to compete with others and kind of shove them out of the way. But again, this is where research proves us wrong. If we take care of the people around us, we nurture the relationships with our coworkers, if we help others out, we end up more successful in the long run. This is, of course, assuming you don't let people take advantage of you, but I assume people are smart about that. But actually, compassion in the workplace to get ahead. There is no domain of life where compassion doesn't actually help not only others around you, but also you to be happier, more fulfilled in life, and healthier. That's why I wrote the happiness track.
So let me you know, ask a question which might be a little bit of playing the devil's advocate. How do we kind of distinguish between kind of laziness and narcissism and like working hard and thinking about others?
I apologize. I don't quite understand that question.
Let's just say, you run into some people who don't seem to care much about work and they don't work hard. And,
right.
You know, I think most people would say they're lazy. So how do we kind of distinguish
right.
between like appropriately taking care of yourself and using mm-hmm. that as an excuse to be lazy?
Correct. The thing is we cannot change the pressures coming at us. We cannot change the responsibilities we have to work to support ourselves, our families, etc. And so many people believe they have no say over their own stress because of all the pressures coming at them. And the reason I wrote the happiness track is to say that you don't have to change the pressures coming at you. You don't have to change the responsibilities that you're taking on in your life to support yourself and those around you. But what you can have a say over is the state of your own mind. And if you're taking care of the state of your own mind, then you're able to meet all the demands around you and the expectations with far greater resilience. So this is not a message, be more lazy, take more time off. Certainly we should take time off in terms of taking care of ourselves, but this is not a message to just stop working.
So Emma, so let's now take it to the next step. I think the way you described that was really excellent and on target. So how do we go to that step of, and I'm using my words, not your words, there's stress around us, there's challenge around us, there's busyness. What are some of the steps that an individual can do to react appropriately to that and not, my words, let it get to her or get to him?
Absolutely. Great question. Well, in the second chapter of the happiness track, I talk a lot about resilience. And what I mean by that is that currently, the way that people are coping with extra demands in their life is they are getting addicted to an adrenaline-filled life. So they're over-caffeinating, they over-schedule themselves, wait till the last minute to get things done, with the idea that that's the way they're going to be productive. The consequence, however, is that we're constantly in a state of fight or flight in terms of what our nervous system is doing. And while a little bit of stress can certainly help get you through a deadline, daily, chronically stressing your nervous system wears on your health. It wears on your ability to be productive. It wears on your memory, your attention, your cognitive skills, not to mention your sleep, your relationships, your emotional intelligence, and your decision making. And yet, that seems to be the modus operandi. So in the Happiness Track second chapter, I talk about the importance of tapping into the other side of our nervous system, which is the rest and digest part of our nervous system. If you look in the wild, animals will be under big stress if they're being chased by a predator. But the moment the predator's gone, that animal is back in a very relaxed state. The reason being is that the rest and digest part of our nervous system helps us to recuperate and restore ourselves. I've worked with arguably the most anxious, stressed population in our country, which are veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan with high levels of trauma. And we used a very simple intervention, breathing. And through that breathing, they were able to tap into their parasympathetic nervous system, that rest and digest nervous system, able, after 1 week of just learning some of these simple breathing techniques, able to sleep again, able to come out of the basements that some of them lived locked up in, and stop the recreational drugs, the alcohol, the other things they were using, simply by using the breath. But if the breath can work for individuals with high levels of trauma and anxiety, it can certainly help us be more resilient in the face of what we're doing every day and tap into that calming response we all innately have.
Now, obviously, in speaking of the trauma of veterans returning from war or war zones, clearly a group of individuals who have done a tremendous amount of service and experienced a tremendous amount of stress, but to some extent, it's over. What about the women and men who are working in the Silicon Valley, working in financial services, who basically now are dealing with a 24-hour-a-day economy because they're dealing with China, they're dealing with India, they're dealing with the United States and Australia, where basically they're always potentially on. How do you deal with the rest part of that cycle?
It's a very stressful life. There's no doubt about it. And that's why it's so important to tap into our resilience. So I actually recommend breathing is something that we don't think about a lot. And yet it's
most of the time do it. At least those of us who are alive, we kind of do it, don't we?
It's the very first act of life. It's the breath of life, after all. Yet we don't know how to use it. Think about it this way. Research shows when we feel different emotions, our breath changes. So, for example, if you're anxious, it's short and shallow. If you're angry, it's also shorter, shallower. When you're relaxed, it's much deeper. The inhales and exhales are much deeper. Happiness as well. We all know this. Crying, sobbing, laughing, these are all examples of it. What we don't know is what this very interesting study showed, which was if you change your breathing patterns to match those emotions, it changes how you feel. So if you breathe in the way that you would breathe when you're happy, for example, it changes how you feel and makes you feel happier, more relaxed. On the inhale, our heart rate accelerates. On the exhale, it decelerates. So if you take longer, deeper breaths and slow the exhale, you actually can calm your heart rate and your blood pressure in minutes.
I guess that's a good thing to do many times.
And it's a good thing to do in times of stress, but it's also something that if you, and I'm not talking just about breathing, but if you engage in more activities that actually calm your nervous system down, and you do that on a daily basis, you're going to feel the results throughout the day. And this is something that we know from research and that we haven't done much of in the United States, because if you ask Americans what happiness is, they will define happiness in terms of high intensity terms like excitement, enthusiasm, thrill. Now, if you go to East Asia and you ask individuals there what is happiness, they'll say words like serenity, peace, relaxation, calm. Very different words. And so it's no surprise that here we like to live a high-paced life that's very adrenaline-filled, and yet it's exhausting our nervous system. Whether it's excitement or high levels of stress, both tax your fight-or-flight stress response. There's nothing wrong with that, but what I'm advocating in the happiness track is that we learn how to tap into the other side of our nervous system so we can manage our energy and suffer less burnout.
Hey, thank you so much, Emma. Emma, thank you so much. Emma Sapala, who is the science director of Stanford's University Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, the author of The Happiness Track, who kind of has given us some very, very interesting insights into how we might deal with a world that is a lot of stress coming at us. And as Emma said, we can't really change much, a lot of what's coming at us, but we can decide how we're going to kind of react to that. So, hey, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love. And if our listeners want to learn more about it, they can pick up a copy of the Happiness Track, which Emma has written. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. You're welcome. I thought maybe you might want to talk about compassion as well.
Yeah. So anyway, maybe we'll have you back and we'll do that another time.
Sure
so
thing.
Great.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much.
It's been my
Good.
Pleasure.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Tom, as we kind of continue our conversation about this, is there kind of any final news item that you want to bring to the attention of our listeners?
Sure, Monsieur. You know, you and Emma were talking a little bit, and when you're talking about being caffeinated, it's kind of interesting. Just this past month, Starbucks has announced that they have a new partnership, that they're partnering with a nonprofit, Feeding America, and also a food collection group called Food Donation Collection, and that they're going to be donating the perishable meals, which would be the ready-to-eat meals that they have that are, of perishable items, from the 7,600 stores they have nationwide. They're hoping to put a dent in the estimated 70 billion pounds of food that are wasted each year. And the way it's going to work is Feeding America is going to have refrigerated trucks that come to Starbucks locations around the country, and they're going to pick up that perishable food, which was previously considered too risky, really, Monsignor, to be able to donate, and they're going to distribute it to the Feeding America Network food pantries. They already have in practice the donation of their pastries, but this way they're going to wind up kind of also donating the other food items that they have for sale. So they're going for 100% donation of the food items they don't sell. And the interesting thing, Monsignor, is this suggestion came from their employees. The employees saw there was a lot of food waste taking place, so they contacted the management, and the management actually responded to those requests.
Great. That's good. And I think it's great. A lot of people are realizing that, you know, we shouldn't waste stuff, figure out how we do it. It's not always easy to do it, but, you know, little by little, I think people are trying to be more economical in their stuff and trying to use it to help other people. You know, one of the things I think as we go through this Easter season, and there are 50 days of Easter, I think one of the things we should do is, if during Lent we kind of talked about sacrifice, we talked about prayer, we talked about almsgiving, I would suggest that as kind of our Easter practice, we kind of think about, are there some things we can do to bring more light and hope to our world? In other words, can we, in imitating our entry into closer relationship with the risen Jesus, that we spread his light, we spread his hope to our world. So I want to begin a time where we kind of take on these Lenten, these Easter practices of doing that. It's not only about suffering, it's not only about the cross, it's not only about sacrifice, but it's also about helping to make our world a better, a more hopeful place in which we can live. So I think we should take these 50 days of Easter to celebrate, to mark the risen life of Jesus, and see how we bring better hope, we bring better joy, we bring better happiness to our world. So thank you for joining us on Just Love today. We kind of talked about a topic that was a little bit down in some of the violent stuff, but we seek to bring the light of the risen Lord to those in our world who need that. Thanks for being with us. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just do it. Love God, your neighbor, yourself. Our world will be more just and compassionate. The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.